TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Noam Chomsky, Racing to the Precipice. Noam Chomsky spoke at the MIT Star Forum in March 2017 to the dual danger we're facing today, nuclear extinction and climate change. In a scathing indictment of the current administration, Chomsky explained that we are not just sleepwalking into disaster, but that we are actually purposefully racing to the precipice, while most of the rest of the world, however haltingly, are making efforts to avert the danger. In the first half of his lecture, Chomsky began with a question once debated between the astrophysicist Carl Sagan and the evolutionary biologist Ernst Mayr. Carl Sagan was optimistic about intelligent life in the universe. Mayr, however, claimed that biological success declines as intelligence increases. Chomsky returns to the question whether it is better to be smart or stupid at the end of this segment. The climate risks Chomsky brings up now lead up to his intensely personal experience of the beginning of the nuclear age and how he understands the Anthropocene as defined by the World Geological Society. Here is Noam Chomsky.
Practically every issue of science journals provides more grim forecasts. Those of you who read the science journals regularly are familiar with this. So one recent paper in Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics by James Hansen, 18 other scientists, carries out a comparison between today's climate and the climate of 120,000 years ago, which had approximately the same temperatures, or slightly warmer temperatures than today. That led 120,000 years ago to a sea level rise of 20 to 30 feet when much of the polar ice disintegrated. The paper predicts in the near future killer storms stronger than any in modern times, disintegration of large parts of the polar ice sheets, leading to melting of huge glaciers. That's taking place rapidly, especially in the Antarctic, which is the most dangerous. And they predict a rise of sea sufficient to begin drowning the world's coastal cities before the end of the century. Hansen says we're in danger of handing young people a situation that's out of their control, with precipitous rises in sea level not too far down the road, other dire consequences. There are other studies that indicate that climate change is occurring faster than at any time over the last 100 million years, by some estimates, far faster. Last year, as you probably know, atmospheric CO2 passed the symbolic level of 400 particles per million. That's considered a crucial danger point. That's the first time in 4 million years, and possibly irreversible. Well, that's only a small sample of many such reports. They're constantly in the major science journals, sometimes making it to the media. Meanwhile, the Republican wrecking machine is systematically dismantling the institutions that offer some hope for decent survival. And it's not just Trump, it's the whole Republican Party leadership at the national level and also at much of the local level. So in North Carolina, for example, a couple of years ago, there was a scientific study commissioned by the Coastal Resources Commission, and it estimated that the sea level will rise by 39 inches by the end of the century. There was a response by the Republican-run state legislature. They passed a law that barred state and local agencies from developing regulations or planning documents anticipating a rise in sea level. Rational reaction. There was a pretty good comment on it by Stephen Colbert. He said, this is a brilliant solution. If your science gives you a result you don't like, pass a law saying the result is illegal. problem solved. That captures quite well the mentality of the Republican Party leadership. A few years ago, Bobby Jindal, the Republican governor who succeeded in sinking Louisiana even deeper into the abyss, he warned Republicans that they are becoming what he called the stupid party. The respected conservative political analysts Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein of the right-wing American Enterprise Institute, they describe the party, or maybe the former party, as a radical insurgency that has abandoned parliamentary democracy. Perhaps a simpler characterization is the utterly outrageous charge that they are the most dangerous organization in human history, dedicated to ending the prospects for human survival. That is outrageous, no doubt, but a more interesting question is whether it's wrong. I'll leave that to you to think about. Well, I already mentioned Paris 2015, COP21, Marrakesh 2016. Those are two crucial examples. The 2016 primary campaign was quite remarkable in many respects, primarily those that weren't discussed, namely the attitude of the candidates to climate change, which barely got a word of commentary. Every single candidate denied that what is happening is happening, with the exception of the sensible moderates, like Jeb Bush, who said it's uncertain, but we don't have to do anything because we're producing more natural gas thanks to fracking. Or John Kasich, who was supposed to be the adult in the room, who did at least agree that global warming's probably happening, but he said, he's governor of Ohio, he said, we're going to burn coal in Ohio and we're not going to apologize for it. That's the sensible guy. As far as the media were concerned, they ignored it. There was almost nothing mentioned about this. After all, it's only the most important issue in human history. And you can't really blame the media for this because they're following a concept of objectivity that's taught in journalism schools. Objectivity means reporting accurately what's going on within the beltway in Washington circles. So you got to report accurately what they're saying there. If you talk about something else, it's bias or opinion or something, but it's not genuine reporting. So since what's going on within the beltway, including the Democrats, incidentally, is denial or ignoring, or in the case of the Republicans, flatly denying what's happening is happening, then you don't report it because it's not within the beltway, it's not objective. Well, even sea level rise that's much more limited than what's anticipated is going to inundate coastal cities and more significantly coastal plains, like in Bangladesh, where there will soon be tens of millions of people fleeing, probably in the fairly near future. These are flat plains which are going to be inundated, many more later. That's going to make today's refugee issue a tea party. The chief environmental scientist in Bangladesh says that these migrants should have the right to move to the countries from which all these greenhouse gases are coming. Millions should be able to go to the United States. That just fits the current mood in what has long been the richest and safest country in the world and also the most terrified. And in fact, the so-called refugee crisis is actually a serious, severe moral and cultural crisis in the West. Well, these two existential crises are related. The Himalayan glaciers are melting, and in the not too distant future, that could threaten the water supplies in South Asia, which are already at dangerously low levels. So 300 million people in India are reported to lack adequate drinking water right now. That could very easily spark conflict between India and Pakistan, two nuclear-armed states constantly at the brink of nuclear war. Right now, in fact, a nuclear war would destroy India and Pakistan, but much worse than that, could very well lead to nuclear winter, meaning global famine, which pretty much ends organized human life on Earth, which is not very remote if you think it through. Well, that leads us to one final date to look at, one of the most important dates of human history, namely the end of World War II. It was a moment of joy, but also of horror, with the dawn of the nuclear age. I can remember very well my own feelings on August 6th, horror at the events and their constant implications, their import, and astonishment that so few people seem to care about it, either about the enormity of what had just happened or about the fact that we had entered into what may well be the final era of human existence, the nuclear age, the moment when human intelligence had succeeded in developing the means to instantaneously destroy us all. 1947, shortly after, the doomsday clock was instituted, and the hand was set then at 7 minutes to midnight. We're now, remember, at 2.5. Well, we have not only entered the nuclear age, but also the so-called Anthropocene, a new geological epoch in which human activity is dramatically changing the environment. There have been debates about the proper date for the inception of the Anthropocene, but the World Geological Society has made its decision. It settled on 1950 as the beginning of the Anthropocene. That's partly because of radioactive elements that were dispersed across the planet by the nuclear bomb tests and other consequences of human action, including the sharp increase in greenhouse emissions. So the nuclear age and the Anthropocene basically coincide. These are epochs of the post-World War II period. We are also now well into what's called the sixth extinction. It's expected to be similar to the fifth extinction. That was 66 million years ago when a huge asteroid hit the Earth, destroyed 75% of species, ended the age of the dinosaurs. It opened a way for small mammals to survive and to expand and evolve and ultimately become us about 200,000 years ago. For a long time, humans had fairly limited impact. But by now, in the post-war period, we've succeeded in becoming the next asteroid, destroying species at an enormous rate, perhaps ourselves not too far in the distance. There are careful studies of species extinction, and they have some interesting results. They show that this extinction is different from its predecessors in an interesting respect. The earlier ones were species neutral. Species just disappeared across the board. Now, this one, it's different. It's mostly larger animals that are disappearing disproportionately. And that actually runs through the history of proto-humans, our human ancestors, early human ancestors back around a million years. As they expanded their territory, large mammals declined. And of the many species closely related to us, only one survives, which raises some questions that you might ponder. And that includes the lingering question, Ernst Mayr's, is it better to be smart than stupid? And we have a few years to answer this question, not many. So how are we answering it? Well, one step was George W. Bush's abrogation of the ABM treaty, followed under Obama by ABM installations right near the Russian border, allegedly for defense against non-existent Iranian nuclear missiles. You can believe that if you believe the tooth fairy, which Russia doesn't. They have good reason to regard it as a first strike weapon, as strategic analysts understand missile defense to be on all sides. The next step was offering NATO membership to Ukraine. Ukraine is the Russian geostrategic heartland. That was George Bush, but the efforts have been pursued by Obama and Clinton. Well, the comprehensive test ban treaty would at least end nuclear tests, which would be a considerable step forward. But it can't go into force until it's ratified by the few holdouts. Three are crucial, the nuclear weapon states that refuse to ratify it: China, Israel, and the United States. The major nuclear powers, US and Russia, which have overwhelming preponderance of nuclear weapons, are both expanding, modernizing their arsenals in quite dangerous ways. That includes tactical nukes that can be scaled down to battlefield use under low-level command. Could easily lead to very rapid escalation if there were any conflict, and any conflict between Russia and the United States is essentially terminal for everyone. That's pretty obvious. The flashpoints are becoming more serious right at the Russian border. Notice the Russian border, not the Mexican border. That's a fact worth considering. And it's a result of expansion of NATO right after the collapse of the Soviet Union. This was in violation to verbal promises to Mikhail Gorbachev, verbal promises that NATO would not expand, the phrase was, 1 inch to the east. That meant East Germany. Nobody was thinking about anything beyond. NATO would not expand 1 inch to the east if Gorbachev agreed to unification of Germany and a unified Germany joining NATO, a hostile military alliance. It was a pretty remarkable concession in the light of the history of the past half century, when Germany alone had practically wiped Russia out 2 times. Well, that was the agreement, but verbal. NATO at once expanded to East Germany, then beyond under Clinton, right to the Russian border. There's recent archival work by University of Texas young historian Joshua Schifrinson. It was published in the MIT Journal, International Security, worth looking up. It very strongly suggests that President Bush, number one, the statesman Bush, and Secretary of State James Baker, who were the negotiators, strongly suggested they were consciously deceiving Gorbachev, pretending to make an agreement which they intended to violate, and were very careful not to put anything on paper. So when Gorbachev complained, he was told it was just a gentleman's agreement, and the implication, unstated implication, was if you're stupid enough to believe in a gentleman's agreement with us, it's your problem, not ours. Well, there was, Gorbachev did propose a vision of what he called a common European home, Brussels to Vladivostok security system with no military alliances. That's a fading dream. George Kennan and other senior statesmen had warned right away that NATO expansion is what they called a tragic mistake, policy error of historic proportions. That's Kennan. And it's now leading to rising and serious tensions on the traditional invasion route through which Russia was virtually destroyed twice during the past century by Germany alone. The risk of terminal nuclear war is not slight, and that's one of the two reasons why the hand of the doomsday clock is moving so close to midnight. Well, with some justice, European historian Richard Sakwa writes that NATO's prime concern now is to manage the risks created by its existence, which is quite accurate, I think. And it bears on Ernst Mayr's conclusions. That's how we're dealing with one of the two crises. What are the others? How about global warming? Well, we're answering Mayr's question by unilateral withdrawal from the world's efforts to address the crisis, not just withdrawal, but replacing their efforts with a dedicated race to the precipice, even more rapidly by sharp increases in fossil fuel use, that includes coal, and refusing the promised subsidies to poorer countries to develop renewable energy, and dismantling the regulatory apparatus so that profits can boom along with threats to survival. And we can't stress too strongly the enormity of the fact that the United States is alone in the world in this respect since November 8th. And the no less astonishing fact that this extraordinary development barely registers in the so-called information system, should have regular screaming headlines and be the most prominent issue in the academic and intellectual world, which is more evidence about the great derangement. And no less astonishing is the fact that while the richest and most powerful country in world history, with incomparable advantages, is leading the effort to intensify the likely disaster, while that's happening, efforts to avert the catastrophe are being led worldwide by what we call primitive societies. The First Nations in Canada, tribal and aboriginal societies elsewhere. So for example, Ecuador, which has a large indigenous population, sought aid from European countries, rich European countries, to allow it to keep its oil reserves underground where they ought to be, even at a cost of considerable profit. The aid was refused. Ecuador revised its constitution in 2008 to include what are called the rights of nature, having intrinsic worth. The same in Bolivia, with an indigenous majority. And quite generally, the countries with large and influential indigenous populations are well in the lead in seeking to preserve the planet, while the countries that have driven indigenous populations to extinction or extreme marginalization are racing towards destruction, which is perhaps something more to think about. Well, I mentioned that with the federal government now turned into a wrecking machine, states and cities can do quite a lot. And that same is true for every one of us. There are major issues of education and organizing that have to be faced. And again, some of these are unique to the United States in the developed world. One of them is the extraordinary power in the United States of fundamentalist religious doctrines. So about 40% of the population dismiss the threat of global warming on religious grounds. They regard it as either certain or highly probable that within a few decades, the Second Coming will put an end to the problem. Well, it's important to remember in this connection that the United States is a kind of a cultural outlier in some respects. Prior to the Second World War, the United States was by far the most powerful economy, but it was not a major center of scientific or general culture. So if you wanted to be a physicist, you'd go to Germany. You want to be a writer, an artist, go to Paris, and so on. Had personal experience with the residue of this when I was appointed to MIT in 1955. One of the teaching assignments was to help scientists and engineers fake their way through reading exams in French and German. Now, that was a residue of the fact that before the war, that's where the scientific literature was. Took a while for this to be phased out. By that time, it was almost all in English. By 1950s, it was an anachronism. The changes are very real, but they've affected only part of the country. Much of the population is still pretty much where it was pre-World War II. And that's a major task for the educational system. And the prospects right now, at least, don't look good, not with the DeVos, Sessions, Bannon conception of education. The Trump administration has to do something for its huge evangelical popular base. That involves driving the United States even farther off the spectrum of the modern world with the Talibanization project that's now underway. Well, there are major challenges, no doubt. There are also quite a few rays of hope. I mentioned some of the measures that are being taken by state, local governments, even national governments around the world to address the crises. Not enough, but not negligible indication of what's possible. And there are other reasons for optimism. One of them has just been reported by, of all places, Fox News. They ran a poll on popularity of political figures, and in first place, by a huge margin, was Bernie Sanders. Even more among the young, who are the hope of the future. There are ample opportunities, but you have to grasp them. And all of this takes us back to Ernst Mayr's question, is it better to be smart than stupid? It's a question for you to ponder, and like it or not, for you to answer, and without too much of a delay. Thanks.
That was the conclusion of excerpts from Noam Chomsky's talk, Racing to the Precipice. He spoke at the MIT Star Forum on March 23rd, 2017. And was introduced as an American philosopher, historian, social critic, and political activist. Noam Chomsky is Institute Professor Emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he has worked since 1955, and he is the author of over 100 books. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.